You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond, grassroots, community-supported, solar-powered radio, broadcasting live from the Cultural District of Fairfield, Iowa, on this beautiful September day. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. With me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone. A beautiful solar day.
A beautiful day, indeed.
Yes.
Indeed. So, what have we in store for our listeners
today?
Well,
this is interesting. This is going to be very interesting. We have today a book called Waking Maya. Did I pronounce that right? Maya? Okay. And the author, Warren Goldie, was born in Brooklyn, New York. He earned a B.S. degree in biology from Towson University and has lived in Washington, D.C., Boston, and Los Angeles. He worked as a writer in Steven Spielberg's Survivors of the Shoah Visual History Foundation and as a screenplay analyst for Bedford Falls Company. His essays on personal growth and spirituality have appeared in the Baltimore Sun, Baltimore City Paper, and the Iowa Source. He was a featured playwright in Playwrights Showcase of the Western States and in the Baltimore Playwrights Festival. Waking Maya is Warren Goldie's first novel, and he lives in Fairfield, Iowa, so he is here in person. Welcome.
Which is always lovely for us.
Like yes, yes, it is.
To actually see the people that we're speaking with. So welcome to Writers' Voices, Warren.
Thank you, Monica. Thank you, Caroline.
So tell us first what brought you to Fairfield.
I've been here about 2.5 years, and what brought me here, I was living in Washington, D.C., and working for a couple of years there, and I just suffered from overwhelm, you know, the big city, the traffic, the intensity, and I wanted to chill out for a little while and just come to someplace slow and quiet and friendly. I was sitting at a Panera Bread in Northern Virginia, and an email floated into my inbox, and it was from the Transcendental Meditation people, which of course are here in Fairfield. It was about Oprah. Had said a bunch of good things about the town. She had featured it on a show, and I looked at that email, and just the word Fairfield kind of floated up off of the screen, and I thought, you know, I'm looking for a place to have a few months, and it just clicked at that moment. I just thought, this is the place I want to go. And within a few weeks, I was in my car and I was coming out here. And got out here and just loved it here. Wonderful small town, artists, writers, spiritual seekers, very friendly place. And I stayed.
it's not your typical small town.
Absolutely, not by a long shot.
No, but it is really something. I remember when Maharishi came, he said, Fairfield. It's a fair field.
Right.
And, Mom, you actually interviewed Maharishi when he was here.
Yeah, your dad and I did, yeah. That was a long time ago, but yes.
On the radio.
On the radio.
But not this station.
No, this station was not in existence then, but yes, we did.
Yeah. So when you came then, you weren't intending to stay for 2.5 years. It was just as a respite you were planning to...
Exactly, a respite. I didn't know what was going to happen at the other end of it. And I just, you know, as I say, I loved it. This book I had written years ago, I pulled it out of the mothballs. I felt like reworking it. I never had been satisfied with my execution on the book. I always liked the ideas and the character and the story, but... So in this, you know, very creative, supportive environment, I started reworking the book, and that's what I spent doing for the first 6 months I was here.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what's your writing routine in Fairfield like? Do you write at home? Do you go to coffee shops? Do you, you know, get up first thing in the morning and start writing? Or
Yeah, I don't really do it in coffee shops. I find coffee shops are good for editing, but for doing, you know, I like a really quiet environment, and that's another thing about this town. It's just so peaceful. So I do work in the morning, and sometimes I work late at night. And then I will go into the coffee shops occasionally with some pages and mark those by hand. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've always thought it would be cool to write in a coffee shop. In fact, we did a show very early on of Writers' Voices, and we've been on the air for going on 7 years.
Going on eight years. No way.
Yeah. And since 2006 and October of 2006. So one of our early shows, we had Donna Colby, who is an artist and writer here in town, do a show about writing in coffee shops. And it was a lot of fun. So it's always been sort of a fantasy for me. And when I go to a town, you know, go to another city and I find a cool coffee shop, I think, oh yeah, this would be a place I could come hang out in the corner there. But that's not my life, and that's not what I get to do. So,
and this town has a lot of coffee shops. For a town of 9,000 plus, there's what, 5 coffee shops, something like that, at least.
Yeah.
And 4 of them are independent and really great places.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of character, a lot of ambiance. And that's so the attraction to me of writing in a coffee shop is the ambiance, and also the sort of just support for the creative endeavor that you get from other people hanging out in coffee shops.
I was going to say, there's also a lot of interesting characters.
That is true. You just would need to sit and overhear conversations, and you could get quite a mm-hmm. quite a book, don't you? Mm-hmm. In fact, I've always thought somebody really should do a sitcom about Fairfield. We'd have to change some names, but that's it.
Save names to protect the guilty, huh?
Yeah.
You know, that would be interesting if you just had conversations in a coffee shop and then went on to the next conversation, and you didn't delve into their background or anything, just...
Oh, like little...
Vignettes.
Vignettes.
Mm-hmm.
You should do that, Mom.
Oh, I don't drink coffee.
So, Waking Maya, you said you wrote it, the first draft, a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the circumstances, you know, what inspired you? And
Well, I wrote the first draft of it way back in 1998. And I guess what inspired me initially was The Celestine Prophecy came out in 1995. And it was the best-selling novel that year. And it was, of course, an adventure story that had spiritual and metaphysical themes in it that were explored in the context of, you know, a page-turning story. And I thought, I like that, you know. I think it came to be called visionary fiction, and I like the idea of exploring some of these theories through a fictional story. And that's what got me thinking about it, yeah.
Right, and there have been other books like that.
Mm-hmm.
And on your webpage, you mention a few of them. Jonathan Livingston Seagull is one of the early ones that mm-hmm. I can remember from, I think I must have been in junior high or high school when that came out. And The Celestine Prophecy, The Adventures of Don Juan or something?
Yeah, the Don Juan books by Carlos Castaneda.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one that you didn't mention that strikes me as being very similar is Mutant Message Down Under.
Mm-hmm.
And these books they have had a huge impact on kind of our on our culture, on our national psyche. And yet there are very few of them really that have done that. What do you think sets those books that really, because other people have certainly tried and have attempted to write in that way, what do you think sets those books apart?
Well, I think number one, it's hard to pull one of them off because it's really easy to get preachy and didactic. Like, here's the theory that I like, you know, whichever one you're exploring. And and you kind of lose the story. You know, the person reading it is interested in the character and the story. So you have to carefully weave it into the story. And I think that's, there's a bit of an art to that. I think that's one thing that's difficult to do. I think maybe a lot of people interested in some of these metaphysical theories are not fiction writers. And so as far as the actual craft of crafting the story, perhaps that's not their strength. And I think there's a large readership for these, you know, and maybe there's a fine line in terms of the mainstream. Like, you have your spiritual seekers who are always reading books that are about those subjects, and then you have your mainstream readers who maybe aren't so much, but they could be curious. And I think with this, with the Celestine Prophecy in 1995, that had a lot of appeal to the mainstream. So I think it's difficult to pull one off.
I agree. And now, if I recall, the Celestine Prophecy was originally self-published, and then maybe came out later by a major publisher.
I do know that story. He did self-publish that, and from what I understand, he sold it out of the back of his car. He traveled around to bookstores and gave talks. He really believed in what he wrote about. And eventually, when he had enough sales, I think Time Warner got wind of it and offered him a contract. And then it was published through Time Warner and, of course, became very successful.
And that was back in the day when self-publishing meant actually buying boxes, filling your garage
with your
books.
Fulls
of books. Mm-hmm. It's very different today. Now, did you take the modern self-publishing route with Waking Maya?
I feel like I could give a course in this experience I've had, because I started out, like I said, the first draft was around 98, 99. I got an agent at Writer's House, which is a really good boutique literary agency in New York, pretty quick, like in 1999, and I was really encouraged. And my agent sent it around to New York. A lot of publishers saw it. People were interested. You know, some had criticism, and some liked certain elements and some liked other elements. But ultimately, I didn't get a publisher, and so we let that go. In 2003, I self-published it with Ex Libris. This was before the sort of modern age where it's very easy to do it now. And so that came out, and it was very exciting. And, you know, some people liked it. The execution, as I said before, was, you know, I thought it was okay, but I didn't think it was as good as I could do it. So
Now, was that a print on demand, or was that buying the boxes of books?
That was a print on demand.
Print on demand.
And
okay.
I think the technology had just become big then.
Yes.
And that's, you know, where when someone orders it online, one copy is printed up and sent to them.
Right.
And then, you know, last year, this year I self-published it on Amazon's CreateSpace platform. Amazon makes it really easy, and so you basically upload your Word document, upload your cover. There's a myriad of details. It takes forever to do it, to get it right, but it's simple in concept. And so, you know, as you might know, a lot of people are self-publishing now. It's pretty common. Whereas when I first did it, it was a lot different. There weren't that many that were being done.
But if you self-publish, then how do you market your book?
With a lot of elbow grease and energy, if you have it. There's, you know, you have it on Amazon. You have Facebook. You go to Facebook groups. Like, one thing I do is there are different groups on Facebook that are areas that seem to coincide with what the book is about. So I go to those groups and I announce I have a book that, you know, the people on those groups could be interested in. You do readings, you know, you send out emails, you do radio shows.
Now, you do have a reading coming up in Fairfield.
Yeah, right? Yeah, next Saturday.
So that would be Saturday, September 13th at...
Revelations.
At what time?
1:30.
1:30, okay. Mm-hmm. So... is this your first reading in Fairfield, or have you done them here?
It'll
before?
Be my first.
It'll be your first.
Mm-hmm.
Have you done any outside of Fairfield?
No.
This is your first.
First ever.
This is the first thing. Okay.
Yep. Yep.
We get a little practice today. You get a little practice.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
So give us. We're going to come back a little bit to the self-publishing topic a little bit later in the show, but let's talk about what this book actually is about. The plot and also sort of the underlying theme. So, Waking Maya.
Well, it's about a young woman who's a college graduate who feels she's living in suburbia, and she feels kind of like life is a little meaningless, and that, you know, she feels there's a lot more than what she's experienced, but she doesn't really know how to get to it, you know, or what it is. And it starts when she never knew her dad, who disappeared kind of mysteriously when she was a baby, and she finds a journal that he wrote that's buried. And she starts reading through this journal, and it's addressed to her, and it's to her. And it seems to be him passing on some knowledge to her about things he knew, things he experienced. And the finding of that journal sort of starts her off on, you know, the classic hero's journey, where she goes on an adventure. She tries to track down what happened to her dad. And it takes her into, like, a wild adventure into, you know, secret government spying programs and psychic phenomenon and visions and all sorts of crazy things that ultimately in the journey she comes to find out about her own heritage, her family, herself, and finds her inner strength and grows up.
You mentioned the secret government spying, the mm-hmm. remote viewing, and there was a movie about that some time ago. I didn't see something about goats.
Yes, something about goats. I don't remember it either. But I saw it. Yeah.
Yeah. So did that really?
Yeah. That was a real program in I think it was the 1960s, called remote viewing or psychic spying, where the way I understand it was a classified program, but it's been since declassified. Where the Russians had hired at that time the Soviet Union had hired psychics to spy on us, to find where our bases were and things like that, and we did the same thing on this side. And there's a. And there's a number of books that came out about it. Apparently, there was some success they had in these programs. And so after they were declassified, these guys involved in it wrote some books about it. And
now, did you include that in the story back in 1998? Had it been declassified by then? So you were, or were you one of those spies?
No, I was not. Maybe during my dream state. Yeah, it had. The plot is essentially the same as what it was in the early versions. I just think through the years, I work as a writer, you know, and through the years, I think my writing craft has, you know, has improved through the years. And the story is the same, though.
How big a difference is this version with the one that you self-published 10 years before?
I think one of the differences is, and this is one of the, you asked about writing these visionary fiction books before. I think if you don't execute it well, the characters seem like they're going through the motions to sort of exposit the plot and the ideas for the author. Like the reader doesn't feel like the character is real. It's just, oh, here's the author sharing his or her ideas. So I think in the rewriting through the years, I think I've gotten the character of Maya, the woman, much more three-dimensional and real. And I think the feedback I've gotten has indicated that succeeded. And things like just craft, things like dialogue and pacing, you know, and doing exposition a little bit better, you know, and dramatic tension, sort of making that work better than it did. Because some of the agents that saw it very early on said, well, you know, the drama doesn't quite work right. You know, it doesn't rise and fall the way it should, and technical things like that that I think over the years have gotten a lot better. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Warren Goldie, author of Waking Maya. Warren, let's talk about, you said you work as a writer, and your bio has a lot of different types of writing. And did you start out in screenwriting, or where did you get your start as a writer?
Well, I came to writing kind of late. I think I was around 31, actually. I started out, my undergraduate degree is in biology, and I took some computer programming classes in my last year of college and worked as a software developer for a while. And then in the context of that, in the company I was with, there were technical writing jobs, just writing documentation about software systems, you know, not creative writing. I transitioned into that, and then eventually I transitioned into marketing copywriting. So I was writing about products and services in a persuasive way. I've always been a reader, you know, always read fiction, And somewhere around around when I was 31, I just started experimenting with creative writing. I took a couple of classes and started writing some stories. I started getting some essays and articles published in newspapers and magazines, just small stuff around my hometown of Baltimore. And that's how it started. And then I continued a career as a marketing copywriter for the most part through the years.
So how did you get involved with Steven Spielberg?
Well, I was living in Hollywood, actually in L.A., in Hollywood, near the Hollywood Hills, in the 90s. And how did I get that job with Spielberg? I had a friend. Oh, I know. I was before the Spielberg job. I had a job with a company called Bedford Falls Company. That's the company that did 30-something and Glory and Shakespeare in Love Legends of the Fall.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
it was a production company.
Yeah, it was. I was a fan of 30-something way back when, and I was in Hollywood. I just kind of went there on a whim many, many years ago, and a friend of a friend told me there was a job with Bedford Falls Company. And so I managed to get it. And so I ended up doing script reading and script analysis for Bedford Falls Company, where I would read screenplays that were submitted. They had a development department that had stacks of screenplays that were sent in by agents, and they had to be read initially by somebody to sort of, you know, cull out the ones that had potential. And there are many readers in Hollywood that do that. So I did that. I'd read screenplays, wrote, you know, short reports and recommendations. And then one of the people I work with at that company went over to Steven Spielberg's, at that time it was called Amblin. This was before the SKG, which is what it went to. And, you know, she said they needed a writer for Spielberg had just founded a nonprofit called Shoah Foundation. He had done Schindler's List, and he was really in touch with his roots, mm-hmm. His Jewish roots and the Holocaust, and he wanted to have an archive of Holocaust survivor testimonies for all time. As the survivors were getting old and dying off, you know, there would be no more stories. So he set up this nonprofit foundation called Shoah Foundation to do that. And it was on the Universal Studios lot right next to Amblin, where his regular production company was. And I got a job there as a literature development manager, and I was working there writing newsletters and articles and things like that for the organization. And being right next door to everything happening with him, it was really exciting.
Cool. Did you meet him personally?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did.
Wow.
Yeah, he was really friendly. He was really proud of the Shoah Foundation, and we'd be working. Yeah. We were in these trailers, okay, which is not uncommon on movie lots. And all of a sudden, you know, Steven, as everyone called him, Steve, he would come through with someone like Liam Neeson or Kirk Douglas, you know, and he'd be saying, well, here's, you know, this and here's that, introducing, you know, what was going on. And it was pretty cool. Yeah.
It sounds like fun. And it actually, you know, the idea of getting paid to read scripts, I'm imagining.
Not that much,
by
the way.
but it does, I mean.
Well, there are a few perks, meeting all these people and everything.
Yeah, and it's interesting to read screenplays that are not at professional standards, because quite a few of them, you know, were not going to make it. And you could kind of, you learned a lot about writing seeing that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I bet. Now, were there any that, like, came into your hands and you're like, wow, this is really good, and you pass it on, and then eventually it ends up, you see it on screen and you think, I started that whole process?
Didn't happen with me,
actually. Yeah. You didn't find any nuggets of gold?
No, I did not.
Found a lot of lumps of coal?
Well, yeah, there were some of those. But, you know, you'd read these screenplays and these writers put everything they had into it. You know, a lot of times they were not very good, and I had to applaud them for working so hard on their projects, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did it make you want to be a screenwriter?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did. And I did sort of experiment with that. That's something, you know, I may do. I do some playwriting, which is not unlike that.
Right. Have you had plays produced?
I had one, yeah. In 2003, I was living in Baltimore, and I had written a play. And I entered it into a festival, and it was one of the finalists. And as one of the finalists, it was produced. So it was pretty cool. It got to you know, watch the auditions and rehearsals and see it produced on stage over a few weekends. It was pretty great. Mm-hmm.
Have you been on stage yourself?
No. I do have some little fantasies of doing monologues, like in a Spalding Gray kind of way, but I haven't done that yet. Just maybe after the play, as it was part of the festival, so sometimes in those festivals, the playwright and the cast and the director and people like that come up at the end, and you take questions from the stage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mom, now you've been on the acting side a lot in your life.
Oh, on stage. Back in the day.
Did you ever think about writing a play yourself?
No, I never did, actually.
Oh.
Huh. Well,
never too late.
Never too late. Yeah. I've written a lot of things, memoir and stuff. And
yeah.
I suppose I could. Yeah, I'll think about that.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Warren Goldie, the author of Waking Maya. Now, Maya is a young woman. Why did you decide to write from a female point of view?
Well, that kind of the idea to do that is what spawned the idea to do the book. I have a daughter, and I was, when she, you know, right before she was born, I was just kind of thinking about, well, what if I got a disease and I wasn't around, I got a fatal disease. I was being morbid one day, and I thought I might just write a book for her about, you know, what I was about, that she would read. It was just a little strange fantasy I had, and that kind of was the germ of the story, of this idea. And I had, you know, wanted to explore these concepts, so I thought, and also I was aware of Joseph Campbell's books and teachings and the so-called hero's journey and the search for the father, which is a theme that appears in a lot of myths. I don't know, you know, so it had to be a woman looking for a father. That's kind of just the way, because of that little thought I had about my daughter. Mm. And then I thought, you know, today with the Hunger Games and whatnot, that it's a really cool theme, the strong young woman.
Female hero,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love going to movies where there's women kicking butt, so to speak.
Oh, come on.
Did you see the recent one with Scarlett Johansson?
No, but I'd like to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'd like that one.
Yeah. none of this, you know, oh, geez, come save me for me. That's
Then there's one with this girl that somehow develops all of her brain.
That's the one.
Oh, man. Yeah. That must be amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we should go see that together.
Yeah,
There's not a dull moment in that movie.
I'll bet.
Oh.
And she comes by that, isn't she kidnapped or something, and she doesn't...
Yeah.
Yeah, she's experimented on
it
without
her knowledge.
It isn't
voluntary at first. Yeah.
Right, and that's how it all starts.
Yeah.
So how much of your daughter is in this character in here? Of course, you wrote it before your daughter actually grew up.
Right, but it's been interesting because as she's grown up, I find that the character of Maya has deepened. And I'm not going to say it's her, you know, but, you know, there's some elements of her in there. There's a lot of elements of me in there. I mean, I grew up in the suburbs feeling a little bit at odds and wanting more. So I think you start with models of people, perhaps, and then the characters go their own ways. Yeah.
When did she first read the book? How old was she when the first time you showed it to her?
She didn't want to read it for a long time, so she's only read it recently.
And
I think it's an odd experience for her, actually. You know, yeah. But Mm-hmm.
So was she, as a child, was she aware of this?
Yeah, it's been a project that's been around a long time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the part where it was early on in the book where she goes into the conservatory or the basement where all the growing things, and she sees the energy that she's able to see the energy that the plants give off. I mean, that's amazing. And I believe that. I mean, I really do, because I talk to my plants.
Well,
and they talk back.
Ideas.
Yeah, they do. They do. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
No, my plants will tell me when it's time to be watered. I actually get a message.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm thirsty.
Yep.
Well, it's ideas like that I really wanted to play around with and explore,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Things that could be true.
Well, why don't you read a little bit from Waking Maya so that our listeners can get a feel for the story. We can make the print larger if you
want. No, that's fine. Chapter 1. Maya Burke paused in her digging and leaned on the shovel, her gaze drawn to the bundle on the grass a few feet away. What had been Livingston, a warm, wonderful creature, just an hour ago, was now a lifeless mass pressing at the seams of a burlap sack. It was awful, and to make matters worse, she had not slid him all the way in, for the tip of a white paw was peeking out of one end, as if the old cat were trying to grab hold of some grass and pull himself free. She winced. Why had she rushed this? She took up the shovel again and quickened her pace, digging the grave intently under the hot sun, pausing now and again to wipe the sweat from her face, mingling dirt and tears in a kind of brown smudged finger painting. At one point she raised the shovel high up over her head, and mustering all of her energy, stabbed it down into the pit as hard as she could, like a harpoon. When she grabbed hold of the vibrating handle, she swore she could feel the pulse of the earth moving within the splintered wood, as if the shovel had completed some kind of circuit. Quickly she tossed off the notion. She dug madly, intently, furiously, pouring everything she had into it, which was mostly the energy of anxiety, a putrid, festering anxiety that needed to be expelled, an anxiety born not only of losing her sweet, brittle-boned companion, but of a profound unsettledness and aimlessness that had been infecting most everything she touched. She had graduated college, magna cum laude, in May, but now, well into September, in the wake of a dull nowhere summer, still she was languishing at her mother's house, a place she'd been so eager to escape. Most of her friends were out in the world, starting jobs, getting apartments, traveling. And what was she doing? Stewing in indecision. She'd made no real plan in her senior year and now was reaping what she sowed. She dug and she tossed, and the hole grew deeper. Occasionally her gaze would wander over toward the driveway in search of her mother's Land Rover. If Muriel pulled in now, it wouldn't be pretty. There would be no thought, no consideration for Livingston, no pause, only reaction. How could you? Do you know how much I pay the gardener? Unbelievable. But she was working again, thankfully, out until dinner time most days showing houses, and today would likely be no different. Maya, who would turn 22 in August, had been trying not to care what her mother thought for most of her years, but without much success, maybe some day. Staring down into the hole, she stomped on the blade once again, felt it slide into the earth. Clink. What was this? She paused, tapping around with the tip, probing. Clink. She tossed the shovel away, fell to her knees, and bent down low, and squinting caught a glimmer sparkling down in the dirt. She brushed away the loose dirt as a metal surface began to take shape. Carefully she scraped a gully around it and saw what it was, a small box. Its lid was covered in etchings, intricate grid-like patterns that sparkled on the silvery metal, with images of the sun and the planets at either end. Excitedly she dug her fingers under it and pulled it out, as dirt and pebbles trickled down into the space it had occupied. She found a clean patch of lawn on which to sit, and placed the box ceremoniously before her, and clapping the dirt from her hands, lifted the eye-hole clasp and opened the lid. Mesmerized, she stared at the treasure inside, a leather-bound notebook. She took it out, felt the solidity and the weight of it, ran her fingers across the distressed cover, and without wasting another moment, opened it. "Oh, my God," she whispered, staring wide-eyed at the first page. "This is impossible. This can't be." Yet there it was, the answer to a riddle she had tried to solve for as long as she could remember. The page contained a single handwritten sentence, seven words that reached forward from the distant past, as if to grab her and shake her violently. "To Maya, with love, from your father."
Thank you, Warren. That was Warren Goldie reading from the beginning of Waking Maya. And There's a lot of action that comes from there.
You want me to read anymore?
You know, yeah. Yeah,
let's either whatever you want to do.
Well, let's talk a little bit, and then we'll, if we have time, we'll do a little more. How's that?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay.
So she has to find out about him through his friends, partially, doesn't she?
Yeah. Yes. He. She. So what she has is she has this journal to go on. She reads through it and she finds some clues. There's mm-hmm. there's a friend of his, a colleague of her father's, that is mentioned in the book, and that is what sets her. That's the clue that she needs, and so she sets off in search of that character, and that's the beginning of her journey and her adventure.
She has quite an adventure, doesn't she?
Yeah, yeah, it does get going, that's for sure.
Yeah. How did you come up with all these ideas of things that she experienced?
I think the way that I did this is I had an idea of the climax of the book, which I'm not going to say because I don't want to give it away, but I had an idea of where she was going to end up. Not end up, but where the action was going to
lead her.
Correct. Uh-huh. And so it was just a journey to get to that point. There were lots of ideas that I explored along the way, and I guess those, there was a lot of potential material to go through in those things, and I think that's what really became those scenes that you're talking about.
The more you delved into it, the more you found to delve.
Exactly.
Were all the metaphysical aspects of the book things that you had thought about before or not?
Yeah, there was at the heart of it, okay, is this idea that I found in these Jane Roberts books. Jane Roberts had written these books called the Seth books many years ago, and I don't think these ideas are exclusive to those books, that on a deep unconscious level, we all kind of meet up together. And one of Carl Jung's theories of the collective unconscious said if you go very deep into the psyche, we all are connected up, kind of like the spokes of a wheel. You know, we're on the outside, and then within the center, we're all one. And so in one of these books by Jane Roberts, she talked about cultural change and how big cultural sweeps like the Renaissance and the Enlightenment and the modern age were not random occurrences that just happened. They were the species as a whole wanting to experience itself in a different way than it had, which is done on a metaphysical level deep within. It sort of comes out from the inside of us, and then it shows up in the physical world. So just, and this has been popularized in things like The Secret, you know, the law of attraction, the power of intention, how if many people believe or think a certain way, it may create a momentum in a sort of pre-physical world that becomes real in the physical world. That's the concept I really liked, and that you know, Maya's father was involved in. So that's part of that remote viewing connection, that within his remote viewing psychic activities, he stumbled upon some of these secrets. And so as she gets closer to finding out what happened to him, she goes into that world deeper and deeper. And, you know, the adventure kind of ramps up.
We have a text message I got from Bruce Miller, the Filmosophers, at the show right before, mentioning that the movie we were talking about with Scarlett Johansson was named Lucy.
Right, yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. And yep, so Bruce's, shout out to Bruce, we know he's listening to us out there and enjoying this interview. And he'll enjoy next week, too, and I wanted to mention it because you talked about the law of attraction, and yeah. Our interview next week is with Brent Marchant, whose new book is called, let me get this up here, Consciously Created Cinema, The Movie Lover's Guide to the Law of Attraction. So we've got a September theme going here, I think.
Yeah. Well, you had... At some point, she was told that the vortexes all had to do with the beginnings of religion, right? And I found that very interesting.
Yeah, there's one concept in the book, this also comes from those books I was just talking about. These places on the earth, which I've called vortexes, and they're called other things, the native peoples, power centers, and things like that, where energy, theoretically, comes into the earth. And there are places that are more powerful than others, quote-unquote, and some of the ones I was thinking about were places like Jerusalem and some of the places where the pyramids are and Machu Picchu, Easter Island, places like that where there's an energy inflowing. So the thoughts and beliefs of the people that live around these places are kind of speeded up, and things can happen faster and deeper in these places. You know, if you look at like Jerusalem as an example, where so much energy, religions have started in these places. They're very heated places, mm-hmm. and other places that don't have this quality at all. So in the book, there's some exploration about what might happen at places like that in regard to some of these theories that I was exploring.
Now, you obviously have been influenced by the Seth books, and I note that there is a quote from the co-author of Seth Speaks on your book that says, "Goldie's work is on the leading edge of our human growth into new realms of understanding." You must have been very pleased to get that blurb for your book.
Yeah, that was from Rob Butts, who's passed away since, but he was Jane Roberts' husband. And I sent him the book, and he sent me a wonderful, beautifully handwritten one-page letter that had that quote, and he said, "You're more than welcome to use it for marketing purposes."
I'm always impressed blurbs that people can get on, that you can get these people who are very busy and well-known to actually read and respond. I think writers in general are very generous that way. Our guest last week got a blurb from Doris Kearns Goodwin, who's one of the most famous nonfiction writers of our age, with Team of Rivals. And, mm-hmm. and she was tickled pink about that.
she's brilliant.
Yeah. You have some other really wonderful quotes on here, too. Do you mind if I read a few of them?
Please.
Let's see. From bookreview.com, "Waking Maya is a trigger book. Reading it triggers knowledge you hold within. It resonates with the truths buried deep inside and awakens parts of you by allowing you to remember that you already knew all of this."
That's interesting.
Yeah. And let's see. From Adam Ehlenboss, author of Fishers of Men, "A groundbreaking experiment in consciousness-oriented fiction and a serious page-turner." So which part of that pleases you more?
Well, the book. Okay, some of the quotes I use in my marketing come from the early version of the book. It's, as I say, I think the execution's gotten better, but it's pretty much the same story. The bookreview.com was really satisfying. That was from the earlier self-published version. I sent it to Zane Marie Gray at that website, and I got an email, and she said, "Your book is book of the month." And
wow.
It was really, it was pretty gratifying to get that. And she gave me, and she wrote a really nice review of the book, and that's where that's taken from.
Oh, that's great. Mm. Great. Now, part of the, still today, even though a lot of, books are sold electronically, even with the electronic book, a big part of selling a book is the cover. So
that cover, that cover was done by George Foster, who lives here in Fairfield,
yes.
who's a professional book cover guy, and I couldn't be more pleased.
Yeah.
It's so important. I feel just really fortunate to have that wonderful cover. Actually, somebody else did the, I should say, Gertie Leet helped on the early stages and came up with the concept. We had talked about it, and then George did the final cover.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've had George on Writers' Voices in the past, and we've talked many times about, particularly for self-published books, getting a professional cover, I think, is key to success.
Yeah, and I should say it's fostercovers.com. A little shout out for George. It really is important. I think doing a good cover is so hard.
Well, that's not your thing.
Yeah. you go to a bookstore and you look through the books, and they all have these most wonderful covers. Every single one of the books in the bookstores, and you appreciate these great artists.
Yeah.
And then you try to do one yourself or with your artist friends who are not professional cover people, and you see that those beautiful things in the bookstore were not so easy to do.
Absolutely. And then there's also the rest of the physical aesthetic appearance of the book, the font, the type size, the page layout. Did you have help with those things?
No, I did those myself. I probably, I think it might be nice to have a bit of a larger font, I'm not a typesetter, and I sort of just went with that for now.
Yeah. Well, it's well done. And sometimes, the other thing that to me influences when I pick up a book, whether I actually am going to consider buying it, is the feel of the paper, the color and the
quality
of the paper.
The quality
of the paper. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So overall, I feel like this looks like a professional, looks and feels like a professional book.
Yeah, I feel really, fortunate to have that, because you know, it's not so easy to get to that point if you're doing it yourself.
Not. Yeah. So you've learned the ropes. So does that mean you will do it again?
Well, I don't know.
Another one back there somewhere in the background.
It's been a pretty long road. Some people want a sequel to this one. The ending. It's kind of a provocative ending, and.
He's not going to give it away, though.
No, I better not. So I make that a question mark, the answer to that question for now.
Okay. So there isn't. You're not working on anything now?
Not at the moment. Just finished this up, and not quite yet.
Do you have any interest in doing other types of writing for publication, such as screenwriting or script writing or nonfiction or... Or if you were to start another project, do you think it would be fiction?
Yeah, I really like storytelling, so it would be fiction. I'm not that interested in writing about facts, that's just the way I am. I like fiction writing as a way to explore things within yourself and what you believe and finding stories. And it would be a screenplay, a play, or a novel, whatever I do next.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, why don't you, we've got about 7 or 8 minutes, why don't you just read another short section? And this is from Waking Maya. And we'll wake up the Kindle here.
All right. Well, maybe I should use this book here.
Yeah, just use it.
Because I think I'll try to find...
All right. And you're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. And our guest is Warren Goldie, author of Waking Maya. And while he's finding his place in the book, I will mention that we will be running a rebroadcast, or James will be running a rebroadcast of the Filmosopher show that we had to cut off earlier when the show is done, and then we'll segue into his normal Planet Erstwhile agenda, and that's not really the word, but if you're listening on Friday.
All right, this is just a little passage. Maya is in a rainstorm. She scooted the chair under the small section of awning that was still intact and sat there, considering all she'd heard, allowing it to settle in her mind as the downpour became even heavier. Suddenly she smiled as an idea came to her. She stood up and walked over to the corner of the patio, to where her face was nearly touching the clear plane of water that had so hypnotized her mother. She grinned, feeling strangely, inexplicably elated. She playfully poked a finger through the water and watched the rain close around it, then turned her palm face up, extended her fingers out, and let the water run down onto her sleeve, wetting it. Instinctively, she pulled back. That was her reflex, to pull away at the first sign of discomfort. No more, she decided. Instead of thinking about it, for reason could be an enemy of action, she did something that most certainly was illogical. She didn't know why she did it exactly, but she reached down and untied the laces of her boots and kicked them up into the air, far out onto the grass, almost to the sidewalk. She laughed wildly at what she'd done. Then off came her socks, which she tossed away too. She peeled off her coat, flinging it to the back of the porch. Laughing gleefully, she jumped out onto the marshy grass, straight into the arms of the downpour. The cold hit her hard, and the rain soaked through her hair and her sweatshirt and her jeans as she dug her toes into the soggy turf. She could see her mother watching her through the front window, shaking her head with incomprehension. Maya laughed and waved to her, then extended her arms out and twirled herself around in the rain and the mud as if in a primal dance, whipping her waterlogged hair around and around, grinning like a mad woman, feeling the full force of the stinging cold, but choosing to ignore it. Maybe it was a rebellion against the routine, against the ordinary, using what was at hand. Perhaps it was preparation for what was to come. Joyfulness charged through her, and for a moment, for a tiny sliver of time, she felt she had stepped out of the rut she'd been stuck in for so long, shook free of a conditioned life she had adopted too easily and uncritically, and struck out against what? She didn't know, nor at that moment did she care. She wanted to weep with joy, wrapped in the rain's embrace, without a care in the world. For the first time in her life, she felt completely free.
Warren Goldie reading from Waking Maya. Now, Maya's relationship with her mother is also very problematic. She has, you know, at the beginning of the book, as we've learned, no relationship with her father because she did not know him. And, you know, why did you make the choice to make her mother sort of such an unappealing or unsympathetic, in a sense, character?
Well, let me say that her mother does evolve through the book, okay? So she starts out that way, but there are some things that happen in that relationship and to her mother. Yeah. It's a backstory that's happening behind Maya's story.
Right.
I just wanted her to be Maya to be uncomfortable enough at the beginning to kind of set things up to where she was motivated to move on out and do something different. So that's probably why that was like that.
Yeah.
And Maya was tied to her mother because she, you know, that was her parent, her only parent. And even though it's a problematic relationship, it's one she feels, you know, that's important and that she's very much a part of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense. Wow, look at that. It's getting, looks like the storm's coming up. Just like as you were reading about the rainstorm in here, and now we're going to get a rainstorm out there.
Yeah, there's some weather that happens in this.
Yeah. It is. Weather does play a important role in the book, in a way, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, you don't know why. It's people analyze books and come up with reasons why the author did things, and the author's not always aware of why they did things.
I know.
It just feels like it's right to do it. So yeah, it is true. It might be a bit of my sort of interest and background as kind of a person who's very a lover of nature.
Well, the nature is part of the cosmos, and you have to include it in the whole situation, you know, in the whole experience.
You know, as a mother, my mother was an English teacher, a high school English teacher at one point in her career. And I remember being, you know, sitting in English classes and where you're doing that analysis of what was the author's intention in this, and always wondering if the author knew that, first of all, if he had any idea that kids would be sitting in a classroom trying to figure out what his intention was, and if he actually had any intention.
Yeah, I think it probably goes both ways on that. You know, sometimes they do weave in themes, and I think probably some carefully set that up and some don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have a background in I didn't take a lot of classes. I really just took one or two after I graduated, like adult education classes.
You graduated in
I graduated in biology.
Okay.
And then years later, I became interested in writing, and I just took this, it was called creative nonfiction.
Ah.
And it was just writing our essays, but using fiction writing techniques in the essays, not just dry essays. And my instructor in that was really encouraging. And she said, you know, this essay you've written, I took a retreat. It was at that time, it was a spiritual retreat for a weekend. And I wrote about my experience of it. And she said, this is really good. You should send it into the newspaper. So I sent it to the Baltimore Sun, in Baltimore, the hometown paper. And to my surprise and delight, they published it. I mean, they said they were going to publish it, and I was, you know, that was the beginning of having some confidence, and I got $100, and it was just wonderful.
Wow, well, yeah. Just, and then to have it published would be great, but $100
I know. And they told me when it was going to come out, and I rushed to the newspaper box and day after day, and it just kept not coming out, because I guess those things are somewhat fluid, and then finally it did. And it was on the opinion page, and here was this article about a spiritual retreat with all these other articles about political commentary and things like that. But the editor really was encouraging.
Now, are you the type of writer who writes first drafts really fast and like just gets everything down on paper and then goes back and does a lot of editing? Or are you the kind who likes to edit as they go?
The first, yes. By far. I get it down quickly, and I've, after all these years of writing, I'm very comfortable with it not being anywhere near perfect. The question I ask myself after the first draft is just, is there a story there? Mm-hmm. You know, does it have the elements of a story? And if the answer is yes, then I do a whole lot of working and reworking it, and I find the story as I work on it. I know the other writers probably know the story going in. I don't. I just sort of know a certain amount about it. Like the analogy of the marble, I think this is one that's commonly given, where a sculptor is chipping away at a marble block and finds the figure inside, and then the more that it's chipped away, the more detail can be, you know, corrected to the figure until at the end it looks quite right. But at the beginning, the sculptor didn't really know what it was going to be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then how do you know when you're done?
Yeah, well, as far as this book goes, I worked on many drafts.
You were done a couple times.
I was done more than a couple of times, more than I even will admit. But I do feel on this last one, even though I don't think I'd ever say it's exactly the way I'd want it, but it's pretty close, and this is going to be it, unless some major publisher says, we want to pick this up and we need you to make a few minor corrections.
Yeah.
This is it, basically, for good or ill.
I know, because you can always make it better. And so it's hard to know when is it good enough to move on to the next project. And some people make the mistake of thinking it's good enough before it is, and other people make it go too long overboard. It's very hard to find that right balance.
It's a really good question. And on some of the drafts of this, I literally edited the life out of the story, and I didn't know I was doing it, and it was horrible. Mm. And then, you know,
You're left with the bare bones then, and then you have to go back and fill it in again, right?
Yeah. In the last draft, though, I felt like it finally, after all these years, it was pretty much what I had intended at the beginning.
Well, great. Waking Maya, Warren Goldie, he'll be at Revelations on Saturday, September 13th, 2014. I have to say that because sometimes we rebroadcast this and we don't want someone showing up in 2019 and wondering where you are. And at 1:30, Revelations. And thank you so much for being with us today. Mom,
thank you.
Do you have some closing words for us?
I do. People will accept your ideas much more readily if you tell them Benjamin Franklin said it first.
And stay tuned now for Planet Earthwild, which will be beginning with a replay of the film Ossifers if you're listening on Friday. If you're listening on Monday morning, have a great week. And if you would like to share the show or hear it again or you missed part of it, check out the archives on KRUUFM.com. And we will see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.